Hey y'all, how's it going? Oh, good. Well, this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Welcome to it. I know, I should pretend to be all excited and stuff. Hey guys, welcome to episode 10 million of this thing where I complain into the microphone about American foreign policy. It's going to be really great. Matthew Ho is going to be back on the show. We're going to talk about Afghanistan. He famously resigned from the State Department in 2009 and wrote a giant thing all about the surge and how it could not work. He's going to be on the show to talk about, if you just heard the top of the hour news here on Liberty Radio Network, you heard that they're signing the deal today to keep the Americans indefinitely, at least, 15 or 20,000 of them. Matthew Ho, he's going to have some interesting things to say about that. And actually, I'm kind of breaking my rule. I don't think he wrote anything about it. And I usually only go off of who wrote what. But, well, he wrote stuff in the past about it, and I guess I'm just interested to hear what he's got to say. I've got enough questions off the top of my head to carry a conversation anyway, so it'll be fine. Matthew Ho, I forget now if he was Army or Marines. I think he was U.S. Army in Iraq and U.S. State Department in Afghanistan. He's now a peace activist type. You watch a pretty good interview of him and Lande. I mean, it's kind of a slower pace than what you're used to on this show, but it's Bill Moyers interviewing Matthew Ho and Jonathan Lande from last Friday's show. It's at pbs.org now. Pretty good interview of the both of them. Anyway, so Matthew Ho is going to be here to talk about Afghanistan and maybe about some ISIS stuff too. I don't know. Depends on how it goes. And then Mark Weisbrot is going to be on to talk about his article at america.aljazeera.com, Hard Choices, Hillary Clinton Admits Role in Honduran Coup. And I was trying to think, I've interviewed this guy Weisbrot before, but I can't remember when about what. And then now I'm thinking, I wonder if it was in 2009 about the Honduras coup. I'm too lazy to go back and check, but pretty sure that's when I must have talked to him before. I don't know. But anyway, so he's good on it. And it's important because, of course, the whole story over the summer, and I guess it's still going on, of all the refugee children coming from Honduras. Well, what is it they're fleeing? Well, they're fleeing American government-created chaos, of course. You didn't think that there was strife anywhere on the planet that George W. Bush and Barack Obama weren't responsible for, did you? Anyway, so Weisbrot will be on about that. And then, oh, I got an email back from this dude, says, maybe tomorrow. Oh, cool. All right. So check this out. There's a guy named Salvik Chakravarti. Anybody remember him? If you do, then you're an anti-war radio OG, I guess. Anyway, years ago I interviewed this guy. He's a he's an Indian libertarian. And not like the reservation kind, but the subcontinent kind. And, the president of the prime minister, I forget, of India, I guess he's the president of India, is in America right now. Oh, what's he say here? Oh, good. Follow up with some links here. Cool. Modi, the right-wing nationalist, Hindu nationalist president of India, newly elected in the past few months here, I guess, late last spring, early this summer. He's in D.C. right now, talking with Obama, working things out, whatever evil they're up to. And so I thought, you know what, I ought to get my Indian libertarian friend on the show to talk about it. And he says, how about tomorrow? Which is good enough for me. Tomorrow is good enough for me. Salvik Chakravarti. What's cool is I went and Googled his name real quick, and I pulled up his blogs, and they're all attacks on the left-wing socialist welfare state. All good libertarians should be good on opposing root and branch the left-wing socialist welfare state. But it made me kind of wonder, I don't remember this guy that well. It's been quite a few years since I talked to him. And I wonder if he's as good on opposing the right as he is at opposing the left. I guess we'll see, you know? But so just now he wrote back to me, "Oh, sorry, I can't do it today. I'll get back to you tomorrow. But do read my blog post on Modi the moron, posted right now anyway." So, good. Apparently, he has got no truck for the right either. And you know, there's a story about this Modi guy, and I don't know everything about it, but I know enough about it to know it's a problem. That I heard of this guy before I knew I'd ever heard of him before. That's not the problem. The problem was what I heard about him. I believe right around 10 years ago, maybe 9. What year is it? Yeah, almost 10 years ago. When I very first started talking with Michael Scheuer, he would, I guess I quit asking him this all the time, but I would always ask him to go over the 6 reasons, Osama's big talking points, his shtick, his recruitment shtick for getting people to join Al-Qaeda to want to fight against the United States. And he would say, you know, the occupation of the Arabian Peninsula, support for the Israeli occupations of Palestine and Lebanon, support for all the dictators across the region, pressure on them to keep the oil prices low or high, I guess, depending on the situation, but basically taking all the oil wealth. And then, bombing and blockading Iraq from the bases in Saudi Arabia. That's really kind of 2.5, 3 there. And then the other one was support, which I think is perhaps overstated. Certainly in the case of Russia, it's overstated. But generally speaking, I guess it's right, the way he characterized it. U.S. support for Russia, China, and India in their wars against Muslims. And especially Osama's talking point was always, and I don't know exactly what all he said about actual support, but certainly the Americans don't care at all about human rights when it's Muslims being slaughtered. That was what Osama said. And Scheuer pointed out that not long after September 11th, I believe it was in the very beginning of 2002, there was a giant anti-Muslim pogrom in India where like 20,000 people were massacred. 20,000 civilians, you know, there are no fighters, they're just civilians massacred. I think the accusation was that a Muslim had bombed a bus with Hindus on it, something like that. And the Hindus went on this rampage and killed like 20,000-something people. And then shortly thereafter, Bin Laden put out a message saying, "See, I told you. That's how the Americans are. You didn't hear Condoleezza Rice say one peep," or he didn't probably name her by name, "but you didn't hear the Americans have one negative word to say about a massacre of 20,000 civilians as long as it's perpetrated against Muslims by, in this case, Hindus." And how that is really powerful propaganda, that the Americans claim all day long as they kill you that they only kill you because they love you. They only kill you because they're trying to make a better world for you and this and that. But the proof that they don't mean it is watch what happens when the Indians massacre us and they don't say a damn thing about it. And guess who did that massacre? Modi, the new president of India. It was his party. And from one thing I read, he was like in charge that day, or at least, you know, participated in the commanding and controlling of the racial pogrom. And then what was it? I'm going off the top of my head here from a few months ago. I think he appointed the guy who actually ran the thing to be his right hand man, you know, or his new attorney general, or something like that. Really problematic, could be. Very problematic, this Hindu nationalism. I'm going to find out more about the BNP and all that tomorrow with Sauvik Chakravarti on the show, I hope. I'm going to email him back and work out of time right now, in fact. It's the Scott Horton Show. Thanks for tuning in, y'all. I'll try to keep it interesting for you here. Got a couple good interviews. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So now God, for crying out loud. At least now I have read with an R, not a W. I have read Mark Weisbrot's article about Honduras, so now I'll be able to ask him questions about it, hopefully. Yeah. Not enough coffee? Too much coffee? I don't know. Something's wrong with my brain. Who cares? Anyway, I'm working on it. So yeah, let's talk about the wars. No, before we talk about the wars, you know what's interesting? This guy, Jim Webb, the former senator from Virginia, it looks like he might primary Hillary Clinton. Now, the thing about him is he's a horrible person. He's a senator. A Democrat. So, I mean, that's pretty much all you need to know about him, right? However, he couldn't possibly be as horrible as Hillary. And, you know, one thing about, it's interesting about Jim Webb. He did one term in the Senate and then quit. And I don't know, maybe someone blackmailed him, you know, because of how corrupt he is and forced him out or something. I don't know. But hell, if he's going to primary Hillary, he must think his slate is somewhat clean. He talked about he just hated being a senator. He hated the Senate. And it doesn't work like he imagined it could at all, and it was never gonna, and he was never gonna be happy there, and so he just gave up and left. I think it's possible that's actually the real story. He just hated it. Although, he thinks he's gonna like being president much better, I don't know about that. But the thing of it is that I think when he ran as a pretty anti-war type guy in the anti-war wave of 06. But then he didn't really do much to be anti-war. Maybe he opposed the surge in 07. Hell, I don't know. He may have supported it. I don't want to give him too much benefit of the doubt there, honestly. He did run, you know, on the idea that he was less of a warmonger. That doesn't necessarily mean he had a voting record that backed that up. But he is a Vietnam veteran, so if he wants to say, hey, look, I'm actually a veteran and I'm anti-war, and you're just some crazy hawkish civilian lady and everybody knows it to Hillary, then he can outflank her on the right and still be a peacenik. So that would be interesting. You know, he is no Dennis Kucinich, but Dennis Kucinich could never say, yeah, actually, I did a bunch of tours in Vietnam, and let me tell you what real blood and guts is like, right? You know, that kind of thing works real well in democratic politics, everybody, as you well know. And I think that there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party, on the left, and hell, in the rest of the country, who would just love to see anybody but Hillary be the Democratic nominee. I mean, why should it be her? What, she was born with the divine right to be our ruler someday? We got no choice in the matter except for when we have to finally accept it? No. Why? Just because she wants unlimited power, we have to give it to her? Out of 150 million American females, this is the one who's good enough to be our leader? Really? Hillary Clinton? You know, I don't know. That's pretty horrible. She's horrible. Horrible. On just every issue you could name. Just absolutely horrible. So anyway, I don't know. It's not like I'd vote in a Democratic primary or anything like that, but I sure would like to see someone challenge Hillary. You know, everybody thought it was Hillary's for the taking. Oh, this Obama guy, yeah, this is his warm-up run for next time or whatever they said. But the thing is, people liked him and they just don't like her. She's very unlikable. Even Obama, when he was trying to be nice, said, you know, you're likable enough, I guess. When he could have just lied and said, I think you're great. I don't know what they're talking about. I love you. I'm going to make you my Secretary of State. Right? Even he, on the when they put him on the spot, he's like, you know, I don't hate you. I'm a well-wisher in that I don't wish you any specific harm. That was about the best that he could say about it. And that's how most people feel. So, anyway, I just, yeah, man, I hate all this inevitability about Hillary Clinton. I hate it. It didn't work last time. I read this great article about how come Super Tuesday and it didn't all go 100% her way. She had no more game plan for the rest of the campaign season. Now what was she going to do? Obama had her lit. They had the strategy. She made a bad bet that Super Tuesday is going to be a shutout and that'll be the end of that. And then, you know, it'll be, no contest after that. But it didn't work out that way. She may have better strategy this time. But, you know, I don't know. If Webb wants to run as a real anti-war veteran type, as a very conservative centrist Democrat, but who's also a anti-war military veteran, that's pretty good shtick for taking on Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary. Oh, one thing I was going to mention about Webb, and this I think speaks well of him as, in a way, and I don't know everything about the guy, I ain't vouching for him or anything, but in a way I suspect that he actually possibly is a human and not just a politician. And that is that he really picked up prison reform as an issue, and I think really tried. I don't know whether he really succeeded. But, yeah, I think, you know, he helped push through the trying to reverse the racial disparities in cocaine sentencing and some other things. I'm trying to remember. But I don't remember the specifics. But he really did try to make prison reform an issue. And I think it was not because that's good politics, but because it was something that he took as his responsibility in a system that is obviously far more criminal than the criminals it locks up. And so, you know, the kind of thing a senator is supposed to do while he's up there, you know, whether it actually helps him get reelected or not. So, I don't know. I can't stand Hillary Clinton, man. I think, man, you know, if she was the president of America, I just don't know. You know, with Obama, as horrible as he is, and I'm on the record, I can prove it. I hated him since the first day I ever heard of him. I can prove it. I have it somewhere. For some reason, the clip is titled Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos. Oh, it's because it was a stream rip of the show that day. And I'd been playing that song at the top of the hour. But there's a clip of me from 2007 saying, who is this Obama guy? TV says I love him. He's my hero. He's a rock star. So I hate his sorry evil guts. He's a Democrat. He wants power. And no. But still, as much as I still hate Obama and always did, I could feel relieved that Bush and Cheney were finally gone. The dark times. The empire was, you know, lightening up a little bit. But for Obama to be replaced by Hillary, I don't know. I might just move to Australia. Got a couple friends in Australia. Hey, Tim. He's looking at you, kid. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm tweeting and direct messaging, and I'm running a radio show, and I'm trying to read a bunch of stuff and catch up. What the? God dang it. I got Matthew Ho on the line. He was, correct me if I'm wrong here, Matthew, U.S. Army in Iraq and U.S. State Department in Afghanistan. Is that correct? Right.
Hi, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
I was with the Marine Corps. Served with the Marines for 10 years.
I don't know why I got that screwed up. I thought Marines, but then I thought I was wrong about that. But no, okay.
Yeah, now Marines, and then I served on State Department teams in both Iraq and in Afghanistan.
Oh, okay. All right, well, we're going to start with Afghanistan today, and I don't know if we'll have time to get to the situation in the land formerly known as Iraq at all, but I guess today is the day they signed the deal to keep 10,000 troops. Whoa, I got to echo. To keep 10,000 troops there in Afghanistan, and this is combined with the deal that makes, or sort of takes place simultaneously with the deal that makes Ashraf Ghani the president and Abdullah Abdullah the chief executive, I guess, co-president in the new situation in this John Kerry brokered deal. So I guess if you could just break it down a little further than that, help explain what you think this means for the future of the so-called, at least, government there in Afghanistan and the future of the American occupation.
Sure. Well, what you had happen this past spring was fraudulence in the elections of for the president of Afghanistan that was so great that this concept of a unity government had to be pursued because the top two vote getters. And again, the fraudulence was so great that we don't even know what the actual numbers in terms of turnout and votes cast are. They're not being released because no one can agree on them. And again, it just goes back to the level of corruption and theft and malfeasance in this process is so great that there's not even an attempt to put down numbers on this because no one believes them. So to fix this problem, because neither Ashraf Ghani or Abdullah Abdullah, the top two quote unquote vote getters in selection, refused to acknowledge the other's victory, a unity government was formed. And this is extra constitutional, not that the Afghan constitution matters for anything. But this is extra constitutional, and Ashraf Ghani, who is a former World Bank executive, is the president, and Abdullah Abdullah, who lost to Hamid Karzai in 2009 when Hamid Karzai stole those elections,
right?
Abdullah Abdullah will be the chief executive, which is sort of like a prime ministerial position, but not exactly. And I have not seen anything that clearly lays out who will be doing what in this government. And in Afghanistan, that's very important because the executive in Afghanistan has almost all the authority. All the money transfers through the executive. The executive is responsible for appointing everybody in the government from the ministers in Kabul down to the police chiefs and the district governors. District governors are basically, say, like county commissioners. So it's a very corrupt process. It's a very opaque result. I don't know anyone who has any confidence in this other than the spokespeople for the Afghan government and for the U.S. government. And I think to clearly show what's behind all this and what motivates this, Scott, is the understanding that the way that Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani finally came to an understanding that they would share power, basically split the baby, was because the United States government Secretary Kerry said, if you don't agree, we're taking all our money and leaving. So I think that's a good understanding of what's really motivating a lot of this. What is the underpinnings of this? The United States spent $80 billion in Afghanistan last year. This year we've asked for about $60 billion. Of that, is $7 billion is for reconstruction programs, so cash that's being applied directly to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So I think you get a pretty good understanding that that the money is the prime motivator here, and that the Afghan people will continue to be left out of any legitimate political process. And as you've seen, there's been no mention of the current insurgency. There's been no mention of resolving this civil war that's torn apart Afghanistan for almost four decades now.
Right.
Right.
Which is a lot to leave out. Uh-oh. We got a problem with levels over there. Can you turn something down, Matthew?
Yeah, I think the same thing happened last time, Scott. The microphone keeps jumping up on me for some reason.
Yeah. Well, you sound fine. I don't know. Maybe it's your speakers feeding back through your mic a little bit. It shouldn't do that. I'm blaming Skype, not you. They haven't got that all on
yet. You know what?
Yet.
Since I've only had this problem since I upgraded to the new Skype.
Yeah, I think maybe a setting has changed or something. Anyway, it's okay now. I think sounds good, right, chat room guys? I don't hear the echo anymore, so we'll continue. Okay, there's a lot there. First of all, is this just a contest of who gets to shoot who in the back of the head first between Ghani and Abdullah, or does anybody think that this is actually going to be a thing, that they're going to be co-presidents like this and get along somehow?
I don't see how. I mean, again, the thing that I go back to, Scott, that would make this, that keeps this together is the money. And the understanding amongst Ghani and Abdullah and their camps that the only way to keep the American cash cow, the $7 billion a year that we're providing directly to the Afghan government, basically, the only way to keep that is to put on a good face and stand in front of the crowd on a podium together and hold hands.
Mm-hmm.
But behind the scenes, absolutely, I think that's a good description. And certainly, if you're familiar with Afghan history, modern Afghan history, prior to the Soviet invasion in the 70s, you had lots of Afghan leaders shooting other Afghan leaders in the back of the head.
Yeah.
So I think all you've seen in Afghanistan is a continuation of these politics, this conflict that has been, carried forth by, real internal divisions in Afghanistan, but then also outside interference, whether it be the Americans or the Russians or by the Indians or the Pakistanis. But certainly there's quite a lot for the Afghans to contend with.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, what does it say for the American empire that after all this occupation for 13 years, really with at least stability in the palace in Kabul under Hamid Karzai all this time and all the chance, all the money they've spent, all the chance they've had to build things up the way that, with the blank check that the American people have signed for them, that they can't even pull off an election, a simple kind of presidential election at all. I mean, to read Matthew Aid and Anand Gopal on, I think, their reporting in Harper's was on the first round of the election here, where the people out in the countryside didn't even get to vote at all. Basically, you get to vote if the cameras are there, for the international press. And otherwise, the whole thing is just a put on. And then with the dispute over Abdullah, like now they're trying to work out this thing where don't release the numbers, because the numbers now are going to say that Ghani won. But Abdullah is so convinced that he really won in the first round, even though they double extra stole the second round. What are we even talking about here? This is the most ridiculous exercise in so-called democracy ever. It's like some skit from the Kids in the Hall or something. And this is what Bush and Obama have to show for 13 years of occupation and nation building. And then at the end, with their surge failed and all the rest of it down around their ankles, all they can say is, well, I guess we got to keep 10,000 troops for another 10 years, 2024. Which that's the deal that Obama had actually signed with Karzai, less the details, a couple years ago. And now the dang music's playing because I complained too long to get to my question. But we're going to go out to break, and then we're going to get back and talk more with Matthew Ho about the horrible catastrophe in Afghanistan. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Stars and Stripes says they got a new story about the new American Veterans Disabled for Life Memorial in Washington, D.C. Because it's high time that the maimed had a little statue of their own. And there are plenty more coming where that came from. It looks like they signed this deal till 2024, and it, of course, includes the all-important immunity, Matthew, so that the U.S. Army can continue to operate, I guess, in with only 10 or 20,000 people there. What does that even, does that count as counterterrorism forces? Does that mean Delta Force night raids are going to continue indefinitely kind of thing? Or is that just force protection for the capital city?
I think you're still going to see some limited raids occurring, but mainly I think that that presence, Scott, is mainly directed outwards towards Iran and Pakistan. You're looking at the primary purpose of the U.S. presence there being both those countries opposed to Afghanistan. So utilizing the airfields in Afghanistan to conduct reconnaissance and strike missions into both Pakistan and potentially Iran in the future.
But doesn't that assume stability and American-friendly control in Afghanistan? And isn't that a pretty big assumption at this point?
Right, you know, but I don't think anyone is accusing our government of having any type of forward thinking or long-term vision or empathetic understanding of national and regional difficulties in that area. I mean, precisely, Scott, if our presence in Afghanistan is dependent upon stability, and we want that presence so that we can fly missions into Pakistan and Iran, well, then Pakistan and Iran is going to do everything possible to ensure that Afghanistan is instable. And so, of course, we get back to it. The Afghan people pay for the geopolitical maneuvering out of Washington, D.C., these folks in D.C. who want to play their version of risk. Mm-hmm. And you see this throughout, this inability to think logically or think two or three steps ahead. In 2009, getting back to the elections, mm-hmm. in 2009 when I was in Afghanistan, I participated in the elections, and it was magnificent how well run those elections were from a fraudulent and crooked standpoint. It was a thing of beauty how rigged those elections were. And here's the problem is when the American government not just accepted those elections in 2009 and said, Hamid Karzai, you're our guy. We didn't accept the elections. We sent him 30,000 more troops.
Well, but in that election, wasn't it that the CIA was trying to rig the thing for Abdullah Abdullah and just Karzai rigged it better for himself?
I've heard that. Where I was, I certainly saw how well Karzai's people rigged it and how well integrated the security forces were in it. Where I was, I went to the Afghan army base and they just had their soldiers voting over and over again. And just all the way everything was handled, from the way the ballots were distributed to the way they were collected to the way they were shipped, just was was watertight to ensure that no one could observe and that the ballot boxes could be stuffed or counted in any way that was desired.
It just seemed like the politics here were that Obama was sick and tired of Karzai and hated him and wanted to get rid of him. And the CIA even put a story in the New York Times saying that Karzai's brother is a CIA agent and a drug dealer in order to discredit him, which I thought was pretty funny. It was, I think, written by CIA staff was the byline on the damn thing.
The reality was Karzai's brother was a drug dealer. He was
Of course. But CIA is outing him as a CIA agent and a heroin pusher in order to discredit him so that they can replace him is, a little bit Mad Magazine for me, but okay.
But, so that's the problem. We participate in these things. We sanction them. We try and have our hands behind things. We try and pull the levers so that our results come out. And that may make sense for a year or two, but now look at what's happening in Afghanistan, where you've got this, because we sanctioned fraudulent elections, agreed with them, sent more troops. One, we have no ground to stand on to criticize Iranian elections or Ukrainian elections or whatever. But the other is that now how do you walk back from a fraudulent process? How do you now say in Afghanistan, this is no good? When you've sanctioned, and further, what you've done politically in Afghanistan is by cutting out, and this is what I really saw a lot of damage was done, by allowing Karzai to keep power in 2009, that disenfranchised, not the Pashtuns, because they were already disenfranchised and they were fighting with the Taliban in this insurgency, but it disenfranchised those groups that made up Karzai's coalition. And that's why you've seen an even more fractured more disparate situation in Afghanistan, where you have these warlords over the last several years in the north and the west have just basically entrenched themselves. And so Kabul really is its own, on its own little orbit, its own, you know, different from the rest of the country.
Yeah.
So getting back to those 10,000 troops, those American troops.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think primarily they're going to be focused on air bases. They'll still be doing some training for Afghan security forces, but their primary focus will be, missions into Iran and Pakistan, drone missions, you know, backing those up, protecting the airfields, maintaining those aircraft, as well as them as being able to conduct strike missions, whether in Afghanistan or in Pakistan.
Mm. Well, you know, I don't know if I'm really reading you right here or not, Matthew, but it sounds to me like what you're talking about, basically, and, you know, I'm not saying this is the last time they looked at it, but it doesn't sound like they've changed the plan for what to do since back before the surge, that by 2014, this is how it's going to be. And so we're going to have these outward focused bases will be left and whatever, but everything will be taken care of by them because David Petraeus promised that by July 2011, he will bring the bloody nosed Taliban to the table and they will agree to all of his terms because he will have whooped them so bad for the last year and a half, in the surge. And so, everything's fine. But it sounds to me like what you're saying is that they're completely setting, you know, the way I said, are they going, they're going to still be fighting the Taliban or is this force protection for Kabul? And your answer was neither. There is no force protection for Kabul to prevent the, or other than maybe a few drone pilots or something, but no real force there to prevent the Taliban from marching straight back in. Because they're operating on a plan that was written up before the surge completely failed. Am I right about that? Am I understanding you correctly about that?
That's right. And if you just want to see, you take it to its disgusting conclusion, is read the press release the White House put out today about this agreement that we're going to keep 10,000 more troops in Afghanistan. And the glowing terms, it speaks of American policy and the successes we've had in Afghanistan and how we've brought democracy to Afghanistan and how we've, you know, we've avenged 9/11 and all these things that are so the dichotomy from reality, and it really is disgusting to read that press statement because it's so so obscene in its dissonance from what is actually occurring there, you know, and certainly you look at all the facets, all the things going on in Afghanistan. You look at the insurgency and more Afghan civilians have been killed this year than last year, and last year more were killed than the previous year. And so the violence keeps getting worse. The insurgency, the Taliban, is bigger and stronger. They're emboldened. They withstood our surge, and now they're in complete control of the negotiation process. They come and go as they please. The corruption is just endemic. And we have spent more money in Afghanistan on reconstruction than we spent on the Marshall Plan in Europe after World War II. In today's dollars, we spent about $100 billion on the Marshall Plan after World War II to rebuild Europe and widely claimed as successful, and it was. In Afghanistan, we have spent already $104 billion trying to rebuild Afghanistan, and it has been a complete failure, and we're continuing to spend money. Again, we'll spend $7 billion more this year trying to rebuild Afghanistan. So just the dissonance that is between what our government is saying and I think what many of them believe and what's actually occurring in Afghanistan allows things to occur, Scott, like you said, where, hey, in 2009, we said we're going to do this and now we're doing it and it shows that we're winning when the reality is that we're not winning. We're losing. We're making the situation worse. We're wasting just resources, both lives and treasure. At a level that we just simply can't sustain, and it's immoral to do, let alone the destruction that we're causing in that part of the world.
Yeah. Hey, real fast here, can you give me any kind of ballpark number on how many Taliban fighters there are now in Taliban?
I haven't seen, you know, they stopped, you know, a couple
10,
of years
20,
ago.
20, 30, 40?
About 30, 40,000 would probably be the estimate, but probably more than that reality in terms of supporters and their networks.
Yeah. All right, everybody, that's Matthew Ho. He was with the Marine Corps in Iraq and the State Department in Iraq and Afghanistan. He writes at the Huffington Post. And I'm sorry, I don't have all your information in front of me. Can you give me, is it MatthewHo.com?
H-O-H? Yeah, MatthewHo.com. Yep. Right.
Okay, thanks very much, dude. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Scott. You have a good one.
You too. All right, y'all. We'll be right back after this. Hey, I'll Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
God dang! Would you look at this, man? Thomas Jefferson's ad that he put in the newspaper for a runaway slave named Sandy. There's a bounty on his head. I'll pay you $40. Thomas Jefferson wrote. God, what a disgusting world. Yeah, anyway. You know. He's one of the greatest Enlightenment, I guess I wouldn't say thinkers, but at least proselytizers of individualist Enlightenment thinking. It's not that the king doesn't have a divine right, you see. It's just that we all have just as much divine right as him. So, how could he possibly have the authority to rule over us? Man, isn't that beautiful? I like it. I think it's great. Yeah, he was a horrible person. Absolutely. All right. Well, anyway, so, this is the show. I'm Scott Horton, and, I do like the Declaration of Independence, but anyway. You know, I guess I kind of skipped over this yesterday, but I decided today that I think it's extra important to talk about, how they have lied us into this war. I mean, I might think, maybe I haven't paid as much attention because I might think that they would just point to the reality of just what devils these ISIS guys are. They really are mean bastards. And then that would be the end of that. Some beheadings here, some murders there. But, nope, that's not good enough. Our government can't have a war. It just wouldn't be complete unless they lie us into it. And so, let me see here, I should have Googled this during the break, I admit. Sinjar. Okay, so first of all, CNN has the story, and I think they were among the first to say, oh my God, there's a genocide taking place on Mount Sinjar. Remember thinking it was funny that how come the Yazidis can climb Mount Sinjar, but the Islamic State can't climb the mountain? Why are they stranded, isolated on the mountain? It's like that one time that the Romans had all the Jews cornered at that giant rock and they all ended up committing suicide by jumping off the backside or whatever, remember? I don't know my ancient history that well, but you know what I'm talking about. So that was how they sold it. It's like these poor Yazidis, they're completely cornered. They're at the top of a mountain, they can't get down, they're gonna die. There's 400,000 of them. There's gonna be a genocide, Barack Obama said. A genocide. We have to stop them. Reason Magazine clicked their heels and saluted. Yes, dear leader, must go rescue the Yazidis, they cried. And then CNN came out and said, you know what? That mass evacuation of 400,000 Yazidis from Mount Sinjar is not going to happen. You know why? Because there's only a few thousand of them there. Now in the low thousands became the story. Why did they even admit the truth? Why didn't they just keep lying? I guess it didn't matter. Low thousands, and they want to stay there. And by the way, it wasn't ISIS that was killing them at all. It was their neighbors. The next village over of Sunni Arabs, I guess, were taking the opportunity to try to suck up to the Islamic State by attacking them. Not that the Islamic State made them do it. And then it was the PKK, Kurdish Communist Militia, that came and rescued the some that needed rescuing, which was, again, low thousands. There you go. There's your Gulf of Tonkin. There's your babies in incubators. There's your Belgian babies on bayonets and your Pearl Harbor out of the clear blue sky and all the rest of them.
Just lie right into war. And then, that was for the Iraq side of this. We're still, our government is still pretending now that there's such a thing as Syria and Iraq. That's part of their policy. So, to launch the Syrian side of the war, they needed a whole new campaign. The fake terror threat used to justify bombing Syria by Glenn Greenwald and Murtaza Hussein. And it's about this story about Khorasan. Now, I knew Phil Giraldi was going to say, yeah, right. So I brought him on the show for you. I guess they came out with this crap on a Friday. So I had Phil on the next Monday to say, I ain't afraid of no Khorasan, and neither should you either. And it's just Al-Qaeda in Syria. It's just the al-Nusra front, and it's a bunch of hype, and don't worry about it. So, you know, obvious enough. However, what Greenwald and Hussein have done here is a favor to us. This is going to be an important article to link back to on into the future. Like some of the great debunkings of the so-called genocidal attack on Benghazi that Gaddafi was supposedly about to launch back in 2011. So anyway, they really go through and cite piece by piece, source by source, in order, which news organization came out with what hype, how they all spun it like it was this awesome investigative journalism that they had done, breaking these secrets loose from the jaws of these, you know, otherwise classified and silent administration officials, when of course all they're doing is regurgitating what they're told off the record. It's all anonymous sources making the accusations. And how it turned out at the end, when people finally, you know, actual journalists finally had the time to investigate, that the whole thing was made up. There was no Khorasan group. There was no one in Syria who had ever heard of such a thing. It was just some al-Nusra guys. The only reason they were calling them the Khorasan group, well, there are a couple of reasons, but mostly it was because the Americans were trying to pretend, imagine this, that there's something redeeming in the al-Nusra front. Yeah, they may be sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York. But anyway, the ones who are trying to attack and kill us, why, they're a separate, different subset of the al-Nusra front. So we're not necessarily attacking the Nusra front when we're attacking these guys who are planning attacks on us, they said. And then they even came out and admitted, oh yeah, and by a planning attacks on us, what we mean is, you know, they had talked about before that maybe they might want to. Aspirational rather than operational. How many times have we heard that one? That's like person of interest now. That's new, a new official phrase of the new speak, 12th edition dictionary now for the American Empire. Aspirational, but not operational. That's what they concede later when they're admitting that they were lying, when they told you that there was a threat, but it was a lie. And imagine, what is it that they think? That the al-Nusra front are those the moderates that they're going to train up to fight against ISIS and Assad? Is that what they think? That they're going to be able to rename them all something else? That they're going to convince them to denounce Zawahiri or any of that? No, probably not. I think the answer's right here in the New York Times. John Glazer tweeted this out this morning. Opposition in Syria is skeptical of U.S. airstrikes on ISIS. And these are all the guys in the Free Syrian Army saying, hey, stop bombing our friends in the al-Nusra front. You know, al-Qaeda in Syria. Oh, sure, you're going to bomb ISIS and you're going to bomb Nusra, but not Assad. America has become the arm of Bashar the terrorist, read a sign by a protesting child. And as Roy Gutman, I think, put it in the most frank language in the mainstream media about this, the Americans are very concerned about offending the members of the Free Syrian Army and the so-called moderate vetted rebels that they're trying to pull together here by bombing the al-Nusra front, which they like and are loyal to, if not outright members of. Al-Qaeda in Syria. And
All this based on some fantasy that no one believes in. I mean, man, I'm sorry. I've been trying to read all the think tanks and all the warmongers and everything, and nobody really believes that this strategy is going to work, that they're going to do some kind of awakening in Syria where non-Islamist rebels end up killing all the Islamist rebels and Assad and all of his supporters too. Are you crazy? Just imagine. It's just like the invasion of Iraq. Never mind what happens after that. What happens after Assad falls? And there is no organized state army anymore protecting all the different kinds of Christians and Shia and Druze and Kurds. It'll be 10 times worse than it is already there. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Grant Smith is going to be on. And so's Mark Weisbrot, if you bear with me. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking about the war. And, you know, I've been making too much of just a utilitarian case against this war because, you know, I figure nobody has any principles, so why appeal to them? But I shouldn't neglect to mention that you just got no right. And I mean you as in civilian Americans. You got no right to encourage this government, which has no right whatsoever, to go over there and kill people. To start another war. Haven't you learned? And now again, forget the utilitarianism. You got no right to spend one more taxed dollar to kill one more Iraqi. And it's madness that anyone in this society, even in Washington, D.C., could convince themselves that their violence is the solution to the problem that their violence has created. And I don't want to sound like some stupid hippie which I like stupid hippies. I don't mean to offend stupid hippies, but I'm not one. And I'm not saying, oh, just give peace a chance kind of thing. I realistically think it's the best solution to the problem of the dictatorship of Omar Baku al-Baghdadi is to do nothing. But I am not saying that for America to do nothing will mean that peace will break out across the world, that everything even will get better necessarily. But what it will mean is that America's no longer the ones making it worse and worse and worse. And, you know, if there is a God or there are gods anywhere, you know, they're going to get back at us for running around pretending like we're helping people as we blast their bodies apart with high explosives all the time. This lie is getting old, old, old. Oh, the Islamic State. They're butchers. You know what they did? Go look at it right now on Live Leak as they round up hundreds of people and machine gun them all to death. Oh, that's the average day in the American Empire. Bombing people in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and now Iraq and Syria. Iraq again and Syria. And never mind our proxy armies, like all the people killed by the Ethiopians under American orders around the world. And that's just one example. There's a hell of a lot more than that. Like it's less brutal to behead someone with shrapnel from high explosives than with a knife. Like when Americans use euphemistic terms like strike, when they mean tear people's bodies to little pieces with high explosives, that makes it any better? That the terror and the grief of the survivors is any less? So you dress it up in a bunch of crap, a bunch of advertising shtick. And the strategy is ridiculous. It can't work. We know going into this thing, it can't work. It will not work. Every option that the American government has on its face, has a reason why that option is more harm than good. To ally with the Iraqi government, to ally with the Shiite militias, with the Iranians, with the Kurds, with the Turks, with the Syrians, with the Jordanians, with the sheikhs and kings and sultans and emirs and dictators of the Gulf. With the tribal sheikhs, even of Sunnistan, now of the Islamic State. Anyone we help in this situation, we make the entire situation worse. But meanwhile, and you just heard me rattle them all off, you can get a map and go around counterclockwise is the way I think of it, and just go around and tick off all of the landlocked Islamic State's enemies. Now, you know, the Turks, that depends on whether Barack Obama is even trying to put them in line or not anymore. It doesn't look like it. And speaking of the strategy being a complete joke, and this is just one small example, never mind that they can't ally with Iran and Syria in order to back the Iraqi government and the Syrian army in order, and the Russians for that matter, in order to crush these guys. Sure as hell can't do that. We can't rely on our allies, the Turks, either. And you can't rely on Obama to put, even at this late date, to put the interests of fighting the Islamic State, his declared enemy, before his loyalty to Turkey. And so you can watch this on CNN happening all damn day long. The Islamic State for days and days has been attacking a region called Kobane. Yeah, don't get distracted by the crappy pop music from the 90s that always sucked. But anyway, it's just this region called Kobane, and ISIS has been attacking and attacking. The Americans aren't doing a thing about it. They're not hitting those targets, and why not? Because they're attacking the PKK, communist rebel militia, that the Turks, and therefore the Americans, consider terrorists. That Bill Clinton, as Noam Chomsky, more than anyone in the West, likes to point out and has pointed out for 20 years now, Bill Clinton especially aided and abetted the Turkish war against the Turkish Kurds to the tunes of tens and tens of thousands of people killed. I think high tens, maybe more than 100,000 people killed. And they have better relations with the Iraqi Kurds now. And I guess the worst part of that war ended in the late 90s. I think it was 99. Their leader was killed. And so they kind of negotiated since then for autonomy and rather than independence. And the war had died down some. But the PKK still attacks targets inside Turkey from time to time, although it's not as bad as, you know, the fighting isn't as bad as it was. But in this case, here the Turks are clearly saying, and I believe this is probably Patrick Coburn, who I'm cribbing from here. I've been reading so much about this, it's hard for me to keep it straight anymore, guys. My brain's getting old. But I believe it's Coburn who's pointing out in The Independent that, yeah, Turkey obviously sees their advantage in letting ISIS attack the Kurds here, even though they have to suffer this massive refugee crisis and everything else. Yeah, go ahead and beat up on the PKK commies for us. You know, the ones I was talking about earlier who rescued the few Yazidis who needed rescuing from Mount Sinjar. And so America is respecting Turkey's wishes and withholding strikes on ISIS in Syria. They'll hit them here and they'll hit them there. They'll hit a grain silo full of cowering civilians and kill them. Good shot, guys. But they won't hit ISIS targets as long as ISIS is targeting the PKK, which just saved, again, the people who were the casus belli for this intervention on the Iraqi side of the former line in the first place. That's just one example. And then bringing in all of the dictators of the region. I mean, who knows how many different ways there's going to be blowback from that. I mean, one of the biggest things is that they are insisting that Assad still must go. They're as bad as Netanyahu, the Qataris and the Saudis both on Bashar al-Assad. Or no, maybe, yeah, I guess. I don't know. I need to reread that thing from yesterday about those pipelines, man. Anyway, that's one of the reasons they can't ally with Assad. And why they still apparently are seeking regime change against him. Just whose Air Force is this Air Force anyway? Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, welcome back to the show, guys. And gals. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show, and I'm sorry I don't know a damn thing about what's going on in Hong Kong. I know at Moon of Alabama blog, they've got a piece saying, hey, looks like the NED's been messing around over there. Doesn't take much. And of course, you know, you're in a strange position over there in Hong Kong. Under the rule of Beijing, mostly, sort of, kind of. And it's a one-party, communist party dictatorship. And in Hong Kong, they have limited democracy, and that's been the deal. Basically, it's democracy with Chinese characteristics. And they're in a tough spot, and whether America's making trouble over there, I don't know. I mean, if there's trouble, do you doubt the NED's up to their eyeballs and financing somebody with very specific instructions to do this or that? Trying to occupy buildings and this and that? I don't know. Somebody I saw on the TV yesterday parading around a little Statue of Liberty, like the Tiananmen Square thing. I'm highly dubious. Yeah, I mean, I'm not on anybody's side. I'm on the individual side against whatever state he's stuck under. Simple as that. But that doesn't mean I'm buying into whatever protest or whatever riot is going on against any particular state at any particular time. Especially since the Americans have perfected this, and the CIA got it so good, they just spun it off to the NED. They don't even need to bother anymore. They can have the amateurs take care of it, and then get a color-coded revolution done in no time. You don't even need the freaking CIA. You need them for a real-ass coup d'etat, you know? But for just a color revolution, you know, I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of making stuff up there. Anyway, point being, I'm looking at radio.foxnews.com. Formerly anti-war liberals are now running as war hawks. Former liberal and democratic doves are now sounding like hawks, thinking this will get them reelected. Oh, and it probably will. Why not? And there's Al Franken and Kay Hagan. And, now, only one vulnerable Senate Democrat voted against the resolution to arm the rebels, Mark Begich, who warned the weapons could fall into the wrong hands, which is obviously stupid. And then, yeah, Al Franken's one of the bad ones. Anyway, no surprise there. And I could make up their excuse for him, which is, yeah, but Saddam wasn't a threat, but this Islamic State, these guys are crazy. These guys are horrible. And here's the thing about that. I don't think it weakens my argument whatsoever even if I gotta call it a concession that the war propaganda is mostly right about just what bastards the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria are. They are horrible civilian murdering killers. And, I mean, what are you gonna say? They're the descendants of Zarqawi. And so that means that they're real bad guys. Now, if this is just, you know, the plain old, you know, normal business being done as business goes, then I guess that's good enough. Look, everybody, bad guys. Now we gotta go and invade over there. But how about, what if we could just hang on a second and say, well, hang on, business as usual, the phrase I was trying to think of a second ago. What if the fact that they are such horrible bastards is the number one reason why we should not worry about them and that we can just back off? How about the fact that they only exist to fight? That's all they are. They're fighters. And the typical system in Sunnistan is a tribal system and not an Islamic kook system. And these guys are kooks, man. They're the worst of the kooks. That's what makes them the bravest fighters and the most accomplished fighters in a
insurgency, voluntary insurgency like has been going on there since 2003. But, you know, if you watch the Vice documentary about these guys, or read Patrick Coburn's reporting, you can see how they're way, way, way too big for their britches. I mean, to them, Sharia law is as totalitarian as Soviet communism. They mean to control every aspect of everyone's life. And people don't like living like that. And the Iraqis have already proven it's going to be much more difficult this time. But the Iraqis have already proven that they don't like living like that. And they don't like being bossed around by a bunch of Saudis and Egyptians and Libyans and Syrians either. Oh yeah, I know, it's the new caliphate and everything. And all these nationalities are the invention of the French and everything. But this is my neighborhood, and I'll be damned if you're going to come around here and conscript my son and marry my daughter and this, that, the other thing without our okay on it. Without the local okay. That's been the position of the Iraqi Sunni tribal society from 2003 on. And it used to be, we would say, that the Sunni-based insurgency is all tribal, and except for the very small percentage, which even the U.S. Army, even though they like to hype up Zarqawi and his guys as much as they could, at other times they would admit that Al-Qaeda in Iraq was no more than 4 or 5% at the most of the Sunni-based insurgency, that they were there as auxiliaries and there to help the Sunni tribes and Baathists and just other Iraqi, mostly Sunni nationalists who were fighting in that insurgency. Oh, crap, I lost my train of thought there. Point being that this time ISIS has much more of an upper hand. They are not just a very small percentage of the Sunni-based insurgency. They are the bosses of it for now, but they are wearing themselves thin already. As Patrick Coburn wrote, and this is in his book and it's at The Independent too, these guys rode into Mosul and started doing a census trying to ascertain the ages of everybody's daughters because, you know, our fighters need wives. And so we might just, you know, conscript your daughter into the wife army of the, you know, jihadi suicide bomber crazies. Huh? The local Iraqis aren't going to put up with that. Banning smoking. The Syrians too, man. I mean, I've never been to Syria, but it's been told to me many times that, you know what? Syrians like smoking. And as a former smoker, I know how much I hate Democrats, if only for how much they try to ban me from smoking. I think I would hate ISIS even more. Anyway, again, they're completely landlocked, surrounded by enemies. Not that any of those enemies really have the power to dislodge them, you know, on their borders. But they don't have the ability to cross those lines either. Not by a long shot. They cannot take Baghdad, which is a supermajority Shiite city. They cannot take Erbil, or probably even Kirkuk. There may be a fight for Kirkuk. But they can't really, yeah, and that's out in the desert. That's not in the mountains. It's not real Kurdistan, you know? The Kurds have taken it, but they can probably hold it. But anyway, the Turkish border is not in jeopardy, you know, beyond what their government allows anyway. And without American and Western support for the rebels in Syria, it seems like the Assad government would have the thing pretty well wrapped up within a year. He would have won back in 2011 without all this intervention in the first place. So, and then the people who are subject to the Islamic State government are sure to turn on it and destroy it. And it will be more difficult than the Sunni awakening of 06 and whatever. I think it'll be much more difficult if it's, you know, a program run by the Americans to try to make it happen. It'll make it that much more difficult. All these tribal, non-Islamist, or maybe somewhat Islamist, but not Islamic state types who would like to displace it. Being stooges of the Americans, too, is the worst thing that they could be. When, of course, everyone rightly there in Sunnistan considers the Americans the sock puppets of the Iranians. which they have been since 03. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I wanted to mention, I don't know. I guess it's too late. The punchline won't have a da-dunch to it or anything. But it just seemed worth pointing out to me that this cuckoo cut the lady's head off at the food processing plant there in Oklahoma. That he was stopped by a good guy with a gun. Oh, they say he was a reserve deputy or whatever kind of thing, whatever. He was the CEO of the company. He wasn't there as a, you know, what, an off-duty cop doing security patrol or something that would still be within the rules of Democrats. He had a gun in his desk at his office. Somebody started murdering people, so then he shot the guy. Didn't even kill him, but used his gun to wound him. And now the man is being brought to justice. And yet, there are still, question mark, people in this society who think that only police should be able to have guns? That everyone there should have to also pick up a knife and try to have a knife fight with this guy until the local sheriff's department arrives? And then what are they going to do? Rush in and put themselves in danger? Not likely, I guess possibly. Or just cower in terror outside like Columbine for 45 minutes while a bunch of children are being butchered inside. Guy grabbed a gun and shot a guy. Does anyone have a problem with that? Or is that the last time that any, you know, decent human has to hear from a damned liberal about gun control ever again? People have the right to kill people who are killing people. See? People have the right to defend their own life from someone trying to kill them or someone else. The force has to be defensive and proportionate. See? Otherwise, fine. Go ahead. The guy who cut the lady's head off, go ahead and shoot him 6 times. You know, to make sure that his arm will not be swinging any more sharp objects this afternoon. Go ahead and shoot him as many times as you feel like you need to neutralize that knife-wielding arm at that point. Thank you. See, when someone cuts somebody's head off, then proportionate force is kill them. Anything less than that is a mercy. Now, who thinks this man needed a license from the state to shoot this guy? If so, you are stupid and horrible and evil. Everyone else knows that, that's it. That was the last day of an argument for gun control ever again. Meanwhile, that happens every day in America, that civilians, law-abiding gun owners, brandish and or actually discharge firearms in order to thwart attacks, stop attacks, kill people sometimes in self-defense. Guns are the great equalizer. I mean, it sucks that it's really easy to kill somebody with a gun, and so innocent people get killed with them too. Nobody's arguing that. But it's also a way that a little old lady can protect herself from a violent attack from a brute. And these things do happen, okay? Sociology class. People get attacked. There was one not long ago. I got a million of them off the top of my head. There's one not long ago where here in Texas, a guy and his wife got carjacked by these guys, drove them to the bank. I guess they knew that she worked at the bank. Something like that. Drove them to the bank. They were going to make her go in and get the money and this and that, hold him hostage.
Well, he had a gun stashed in his car. Blew them away. Killed them to death. Right where they belonged. Dead. In dead man land. They were holding a gun on him and his wife, see? He had the right to kill them. They had surrendered. They had abdicated, whatever, their right to live anymore. And he then had the right to take their life, and that's what he did. He took their lives away from them and protected his wife from them and himself. There's one a few weeks ago where there's a mugging in the parking lot until the civilian with a gun says, "Yeah, that's what you think. Lay down on the ground and kiss the pavement until the cops arrive and, you know, arrest you and bring you to justice." Didn't kill anybody, but held them there at gunpoint. Regular civilian, he may not have been the toughest guy in the world able to fight two muggers at the same time, but he sure could hold a gun on them both. And this kind of thing happens all the time. You watch the hidden camera videos or whatever crap on TV. They'll show you 100 times. Well, assuming they're not, you know, censoring with an agenda. They'll show you exciting footage of Quickie Mart clerks pulling out guns and saying, "Oh yeah, that's what you think." And either then arresting, shooting, or scaring away their assailant. How could anybody be for gun control? How could anybody be for depriving individuals of their own, of their ability to own a tool that they can use to protect their life? Without, I mean, look, liberals, make it the weakest female that you love. Does she have to get in a knife fight to defend her life? Is that the best you'll allow her? A knife? Maybe? If someone's attacking her? What if she knows they're attacking her, but they're still 10 feet away? Should she have to throw her knife at them and, you know, try to get like a lucky shot like in a movie with the giant stabbing throwing thing? Or wait and let them close that 10 feet? Or maybe does she have the right to shoot them and kill them if they're trying to hurt her or take her life away? You see how simple that is? Oh, that's right. The physically weakest female that you know does in fact have the right to kill someone who's trying to initiate deadly force against her, doesn't she? Right. How is this an argument? What is the other side of this argument? There isn't one. And if you think there is, it's because you're stupid and wrong. Enough of you. Unless you're willing to condemn the man that owned the company that shot the guy who had cut the lady's head off before he could, and was already in the process of stabbing another woman. You're willing to condemn him, then I guess I'll hear the rest of your ridiculous gun control argument so I can mock it too. But anyway, who would dare? Who would dare say no? They should have all just bent over to let him cut their head off until the sheriff's department got there. Think of how dangerous it is for that CEO to have had a gun in his desk this whole time. Why, he could have gone on a mass murder rampage at that place, huh? Not that he ever did. He only shot the one guy who absolutely deserved it. And in defense of a separate, innocent life. Sorry. Anyway, you know what's funny? I'm not even a gun guy. I just love freedom and I hate stupidity. I'm not a gun guy at all. You don't know whether I'm armed or not, so be careful. But I'm not a big gun nut. Any more than I'm a heroin junkie either. But I'm all for your right to trade in and use heroin if that's what you want to do, too. Heroin can also be dangerous. Could also be a lot of fun, apparently. Some people seem to really like it. But anyway, I don't know. And what's up with this guy cutting this lady's head off anyway? What kind of psycho is this? Well, the world's got some real psychos in it, apparently. You know. What's funny is they could have recruited him right into the U.S. Armed Forces and found good use for him, right?
Boy, you ought to try out for the Special Forces. You're good with that knife. Let me see. Wasn't that George Bush's order to Kofor Black to bring me Osama bin Laden's head back in 2001? Yeah, that's how we roll, as Obama put it. Oh, this is something I never got to say in making fun of Obama's 60 Minutes thing. Did you see where he stumbled over trying to break into That's How We Roll and all of this? When Steve Croft gives him this ridiculous softball, it sounds like your America has to lead this. And then he goes on like this 50-second thing about how we're the exceptional nation, the indispensable one. We roll, blah, 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 that's how we roll, something. Hooray, USA, exceptional. It's so ridiculous. It's like a parody of a parody of Obama. This is completely retarded.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And next up is Grant Smith from the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. That's IRMEP.org. IRMEP. IRMEP.org. And basically what he does is he uses the Freedom of Information Act and other resources to uncover as much as he possibly can about nefarious Israeli activities in the United States of America, up to and including their stealing of weapons-grade uranium from the United States for use in their nuclear weapons program, and on. He's written about, six or eight, 10 books about it. Find his page at Amazon.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. Doing great. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah. You're good and loud. Maybe a little too loud. Your mic actually might be a little hot there. Maybe just back up a little. I got you good and loud here anyway.
Okay, good.
So, article today, antiwar.com. Most Americans say U.S. gives too much aid to Israel. Surveys are more accurate with the inclusion of key facts. Oh, good. Grant Smith came up with a push poll, everybody. Tell us all about it, Grant.
Oh, I'm not going to call it a push poll. Come on, Scott.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Harsh. The idea here was really following up on what I used to consider to be the best poll on foreign policy and aid, which is the Chicago Council, mm-hmm. that does a comprehensive survey with 2,108 responses every 2 years. And so if you go to their website and look at some of the data, they say, well, you know, Americans, they, for the most part, like the amount of foreign aid that we're giving to Israel, Taiwan, and Mexico. They support that. And they also support going after Iran militarily if that's what it takes. And Jane Harman from the Woodrow Wilson Center chimed in on that one on behalf of the council. And if you really start looking at it and thinking about it, does it really make sense to compare U.S. aid to Israel and Taiwan and Mexico? Actually, you know, it kind of doesn't, because the comparison is apples and oranges and orders of magnitude different. So I wouldn't call it a push poll, but instead of sweeping it under the counter and saying nothing about the fact that Mexico gets $206 million from the U.S. while Israel gets over $3 billion, we just put it out there and asked Americans the straight question, which is, you know, basically, the U.S. is giving away 9% of its foreign aid budget to Israel, $3 billion annually. Is that amount much too much? Too much? About right?
Yeah.
Too little?
Much well,
too
you know, much? If you were going to really push them in this push poll of yours, you'd have told them the whole truth that, hey, all the aid to Jordan and Egypt counts as aid to Israel, too.
Yeah, absolutely. That would have been a push poll. Well, I don't know. Who knows?
But, no, that would have just been the plain truth, too.
Maybe. I mean, I don't
no,
think.
No, I'm just messing with you. I think this is great because, no, of course you're right that, in fact, I would even suspect, I would speculate that they even kind of deliberately lump it in there with Mexico and Taiwan in a way where, oh, don't you like supporting all our friends, everybody? Because they know they can get a yes for that. If they, if they wanted to be honest about it at all, they would differentiate the way you do, or at least, you know, to some degree.
Well, in their defense, it is an incredibly comprehensive poll. So, you know, I can see, and they make some admissions, and I mentioned those in the antiwar.com article saying, you know, basically they know that most Americans think we give far more aid than we do anyway. And, you know, they admitted some other flaws in their survey, but this is too important a question. And the other problem is, as far as we could tell, since 1989, nobody's even bothered asking this question, which is kind of strange given the prominence of Israel and all things political here in Washington. So, right. You know, it was time to ask, basically. And so we also put out a survey with the same number of responses, 2,108, just to make it very accurate. It was through Google Consumer Surveys, which has as its pool to draw from, you know, just about everybody who uses the internet. And of course, with sneaky cookies and all of that, they know how much people make, they know their gender, they know where they live, you know. And so it was a way of quickly putting out a question and asking, you know, just how much do Americans support USA to Israel, and a couple of other somewhat explosive questions. So you ready?
Yeah, hit me.
Okay. So the single highest category response was 33.9% of Americans said it's much too much foreign aid. Next category was too much foreign aid, 26.8%. 25.9% said, no, that's about right. 6.1% said too little, and 7.3% said much too little. And so in the analysis, kind of broke it down a little bit. Younger Americans tend to be far more skeptical of aid than older Americans, although, you know, uniformly just about everybody said it was too much, except for those in the 65 category. Only people making 150,000 and above said it was about right at 47.6%, but within that same income bracket, 42.9% said it was too much. Most Americans, so, you know, just by this definition, 6 in 10 Americans are saying, no, it's too much money. And that is direct contradiction to what the Chicago Council is saying. So
right.
I think it's, you know, I think it's important when you're asking a question, about the country getting the lion's share of U.S. aid, and this is what we know publicly. We also know there's a lot of secret aid, including intelligence sharing. You've got to put that out there. Otherwise, the question just doesn't make any sense.
Right. I like much too much as an option there. I'm with that.
Well, it's simple language, you know?
Sure. Well, no, I mean, that's the good way to do it, right? You have two different degrees of negative, two different degrees of positive, and a don't know in there kind of thing, right? Is your choices.
Right.
So agree, we also or agree strongly, that kind of thing. So that's fair. Yeah. But, no, yeah. I think that's great. And you know, if Americans knew, right? What if the American people had any idea about the shape of the occupation over there? You know, what America's relationship with Israel means, what just how much that $3 billion really counts in terms of a blank check for Israel's occupations and criminal policies against the Palestinians, that 60 would be 90. Well, I like
that. Well,
to think.
Yeah, well, it will be 90. It'll be 70 because you see these generations marching forward. You know, the really only thing holding it in check are the older Americans who have some concepts about it that are embedded. But the younger Americans, as they move on, they're going to push that curve to 70. They're going to push it to 80 and 90. And then we're really going to have an inflection point. What's Congress going to do when 90% of Americans say, you know what, this is much too much? Are they going to continue to listen to their, you know, bundlers, or are they going to actually start listening to their constituents? And that's already a question. But anyway, we also asked about why is it some Americans might feel as though they shouldn't be providing all this military aid. And, you know, horror of horrors, despite the best intentions of all U.S. presidents never to talk about it, most Americans, 64%, believe Israel has an arsenal of nuclear weapons. And so it may be that this whole scam called maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge is viewed as a sham or scam by Americans who who know that Israel's got nukes. I mean, you know, the president doesn't have to talk about it. He should, but it doesn't matter. They already know that. So the question becomes, why do we have to provide all this military support to the only nuclear armed power in the Middle East?
Right. And now I thought I saw a thing. Now I'm trying to remember whether it was in your article or something else that talked about how a majority of Americans think Iran has nukes too, though.
Yeah, that was part. That was another question. So yeah. I think that question, it was 58.5% of Americans also believe Iran has.
Yeah. Well, music's playing. We got to go. Hang tight right there. It's Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. We'll pick up this conversation here in a second.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to fff.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014 at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org.
If we can have some positive communication with the militias, and if we can have a plan to bring them to be part of the institutions of the country, we will be able to build a strong military and a strong police force.
There's obviously two sets of governments. There's one that's in exile in Tobruk, and then there's the one you back, which is in Tripoli. So there are competing power centers. Do you support the peace talks, the UN brokered talks that are taking place right now?
Most certainly, I support the existence of one strong central government that runs Libya. What we have witnessed is a parliament that came to existence in an unconstitutional fashion, and that issued some constitutional declarations outside the control of the central government in a city that's 1,500 kilometers away from the capital. And that's what created that split within the...
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon.
Oh, man, I'm going to have to get the archive of this thing. Christian Amanpour is interviewing Abdel Hakim Belhaj, who you might remember was the Al-Qaeda leader that Barack Obama fought a war for in 2011 to kill Gaddafi and put him and his cronies in power. And he was a veteran of the Afghan and Iraq wars where he fought against Americans and was even subject to kidnapping and torture by the CIA and the MI6. First they brought him, I think, to Thailand and tortured him in a dungeon beneath Bangkok somewhere, and then shipped him to Gaddafi to torture for a while. Same kind of story happened to a few different people. Anyway, and he's suing now in court in the UK. He knows there's no law in America whatsoever, no point. But in the UK, he's trying to sue the MI6 for his kidnapping and torture. Anyway, he's being interviewed on CNN International right now, and I can't hear it because I'm on the radio. But later on, I'm going to look at it, and I bet you'll probably want to look at it, too. I'm talking with Grant Smith from the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy, and that's IRMEP.org, IRMEP.org. His latest book is Divert, Numek, Zalman Shapiro, and the Diversion of U.S. Weapons-Grade Uranium into the Israeli Nuclear Weapons Program. And, as we were talking about before the break, the Israelis have nukes. The American people, in large majorities now, understand that they have nukes. And so
you know, the whole scam that, you know, America has to keep, you know, the entire Israeli state on the dole so that they can maintain their qualitative edge over their adversaries in the region, is falling more and more flat. But then hence the whole propaganda campaign about Iran and their supposed nuclear weapons program and attempt to match the Israelis, even though such an attempt doesn't really exist anywhere, never really has, as Gareth Porter and others have shown. But so, you know, you can see how in Netanyahu's strategy, this is the absurd part about the Americans, how easily moved we are. And if he just says Iran nuke over and over again, it'll work on us. But so then that's my question, Grant. I knew I was getting to a question. Is it going to work on us? Or is Barack Obama going to finally follow through and sign a nuclear deal with the Iranians that'll put this fake issue to bed once and for all? And then we can move on to other fake issues. But I wonder if you think that they'll get this final nuclear deal.
Well, before I answer that, I would just like to expand a little bit on what you said. All indications are that with the F-35 stealth fighter joint development of that with Israel Aerospace Industries, the state-owned company, all of these joint programs on Aero and Iron Dome, if you really peel away a lot of this military aid, it really is economic aid to Israel in the form of very wasteful programs that American taxpayers are on the, basically footing. And so I would say that Israeli nuclear weapons knowledge is based on reality, again, based on all of our research, but that the belief in the Iranian program is based on reaction to hype, and that they don't have a program, and yet there's this irrational fear that appears in a lot of other surveys like Chicago's, where people hate Iran because they've just been fed so much propaganda. As far as how is that going to work out, is Obama going to get a signed agreement? I don't think so. I think Congress, which is responsive to this irrational fear that's being pumped up, in addition to, you know, being rewarded by the bundlers and the campaign machine behind AIPAC, will do everything they can to thwart that agreement. It's just too much of a benefit to Israel affinity groups and lobbies to keep that thing going. I don't think they will be able to get it signed. So I just think that there's just too much behind this campaign, that it's visible here, it's visible in other tests of American public opinion, it's visible in the strategizing of the lobby, which has never stopped trying to overturn it.
Yeah. Well, it's true that it sure does seem to be the president and basically no one behind him who cares. What, the Iranian lobby in America? Trita and them? It's him and nobody versus everybody with power and influence in D.C. But also, it's such the obvious thing to do. And one more thing, it seems like the president has really tried, and I know that it is his way to lose and back down because he's a pathetic loser and probably the worst pathetic loser to ever be the president of the United States. But, man, it seems like he didn't have to push it this hard. He could have backed down a year ago. He could have, oh, geez, you know, we kind of tried, but it didn't really work a year ago. And it seems like, you know, like Gareth Porter pointed out that the Ayatollah said something about, yeah, you know, eventually we'll have 20,000 centrifuges or some kind of thing that Kerry could have glommed right onto to make a controversy. And instead, mm-hmm. Kerry said, no, don't worry about that. He's talking about 30 years from now and blah, 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 blah. And they decided to play it down. And that seemed like a real important indication that they really were trying to get this thing done. Last little, you know, bits of controversy out of the way. And now, I mean, that's not to discount anything that you say about all the forces allied against it. But I guess then the question is, the question is, how much does Obama himself really mean to see this thing through? And I guess I've liked to believe for the last year or so that he really is, he wants this to be the one thing that he accomplished. If not, you know, really peace with Iran, at least a nuclear deal that he can say is an end to the nuclear weapons threat to Israel. No? Yeah.
Well,
irrelevant?
I haven't really seen him. I haven't seen him as the type of president who would push that sort of thing through. So, it makes imminent sense from an economic standpoint, from the standpoint of, you know, regional peace, from the standpoint of stabilizing oil markets, from all the things that you would think would be major levers and major incentives for a president to come through. All of those things make sense. But if you have Congress 90% against you with this, you know, constant drumbeat of propaganda and incitement, and most Americans thinking that Iran is a mortal threat to them. You know, if you look at some of the feelings toward Iraq before the U.S. invasion and compare that to similar feelings about Iran right now, the metrics are higher. Americans are even more afraid of Iran. So, you know, what can a president do against that? Say it's all hype and watch it go away? Presidents don't have that kind of power.
Yeah. I don't know. They have the power to lie and make people believe lies. It seems like they could just come out once in a while, tell the truth. And especially by saying, hey, listen, I know you've heard a lot of scaremongering about this, but really, it's a bunch of crap. Let me, just say it right. And you can, I don't know. That's what I would do.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I don't really count on the president to carry this through. But I am very, very optimistic about one thing, and that is American public opinion is changing, and they're really not, I don't think, when they get to a critical mass, going to put up with this kind of thing anymore. So I encourage people to read the full report called American Public Opinion on U.S. Aid to Israel. It's about a 13-pager. But if you want some hope, you know, look at what the people are thinking right now, not what the president's saying.
Yeah. Oh, good call. And yeah, you can find that link, everybody, in Grant's piece that's running at antiwar.com today. Most Americans say U.S. gives too much aid to Israel, by Grant Smith. Thanks a lot, Grant.
Hey, man, thanks a lot.
See ya. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's the show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Mark Weisbrot. He is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and is also the president of Just Foreign Policy. Oh, our friend Robert Naiman over there. I guess I didn't have that straight, that association. Very good. And this one is at america.aljazeera.com. Hard choices. Hillary Clinton admits role in Honduran coup. Welcome back to the show. Mark, how are you?
Thanks.
Good to have you here. Been a while. I also want to recommend, I'll link to this from time to time in discussions about Iraq. It's a great article. I guess it's reprinted at informationclearinghouse.com, and it's called Our Own Holocaust Denial, an article about the estimate of as many as a million Iraqis killed in the war from 03 through, say, 09 there, whatever it was. And a very important article, and I like recommending that to people. Thanks for writing that. This one, Hard Choices, that's the title of Hillary Clinton's latest book. And tell us a story, first of all, I guess the coup, and then her concession to the truth here.
Yeah, well, she actually admitted in this chapter, her chapter on Latin America, which really hasn't gotten a lot of attention, because, you know, the media doesn't actually pay attention much to Latin America in general. Although, you know, there's a lot of reporting on it, just doesn't make the major news. But she admitted that she worked with other governments in the hemisphere to help block the democratically elected president of Honduras, Mel Zelaya, who was overthrown in a military coup in June of 2009. She worked with these other governments after the coup to try and prevent him from returning to office.
All right, and so, help us out with a little bit of background of why it was that the right wanted him out and the excuse, because it's actually interesting, the kind of fake excuse that they used at the time, the same one I guess, widely debunked, I know, by you for one, back then, is the same excuse that she goes ahead and invokes in this book as though nobody knows better, right?
Yeah, that was interesting, too, because she didn't do that during the actual post-coup events because the Obama administration was trying to pretend that, you know, it was on the same page as the entire hemisphere, which was, of course, demanding Zelaya's immediate reinstatement and trying to use the Organization of American States. And that's where she blocked, most effectively blocked them from actually helping him get back to office. But the U.S. was trying, and the media mostly bought that. If you didn't follow the details and read every article down to the end, you probably wouldn't know. You would think that that actually was the position of the U.S. government, and that it was only the hard right in Congress, you know, the Florida Cuban Americans and those people who were really supporting the coup. And so it was a great public relations manipulation, I think, for the Obama administration to be able to pretend that they were on the side of democracy when they were really on the side of this military coup. So in the book, she admits, first of all, that she really did help prevent Zelaya from returning to office and go against the entire rest of the hemisphere and really poisoned relations. I mean, we still have the worst relations with Brazil that we've had for decades, worse than during the Bush administration. That's how it really started, because they were kind of horrified that the U.S. Was practically the only country in the hemisphere that didn't want this democratically elected president to go back. The second thing is, what you're asking about is, you know, she actually takes the line of the hard right in the book, saying that Zelaya was trying to get himself another term of office, and that that's why he was overthrown. Now, of course, the Honduran Constitution, which was written by a military dictatorship, has only one term for a term limit of one term for the president. And, you know, some people think that's a good thing, but really it's there because the military wants to limit the power of the president. And but in any case, you know, Zelaya ran on a platform of trying to change the Constitution. And, of course, if that constitution were changed, you know, who knows, maybe they'd have a second term. But the point was, he didn't have any chance or attempt to change it so he could. He proposed in June of 2009 was a non-binding referendum, just a poll, saying, would you like to have a constitutional convention where the constitution could be redrawn? Now, this poll wouldn't have any effect immediately in June. But what it would have done was put on the ballot a possibly, if they could get it through the, if he could get it through the Congress, it had the possibility that on the November ballot of that year, you would actually have a referendum on whether the country should have a constitutional convention and draw up a new constitution. But that was too late for Zelaya. That was the end of his term. So, in other words, it was impossible for him to get another term from that. The same ballot on which it could have appeared, and there's no guarantee
and then,
it
like
would
you're
have.
Saying, the question wasn't even about that. The question was whether to have that question answered by another ballot in the future. Was
absolutely
the only thing that they
right.
were even
and,
talking
and another
about.
Another ballot where it was too late for Zelaya to actually run,
right.
Even if they had gone up and drawn a new constitution, he was out. In November. That was the end of his term. So there was no question whatsoever of him getting another term. And this was just a flat-out lie that the right promoted in order to actively support the coup. And here it was chronologically impossible. And here's Hillary Clinton in her book just throwing it in there as if it's true. I thought that was almost as striking as her confession that she helped prevent the democratically elected president from returning to power.
Mm-hmm. And now, so let me ask you, just what threat was this guy to entrenched interests in the first place? I mean, it can't have been that revolutionary. He would have gotten anywhere near the presidency at all.
Well, he was... No, that's right. I mean, he came from the Liberal Party, his traditional huge one of the big traditional parties in Honduras. But he was progressive. You know, I don't think they cared about so much his internal politics, like raising the minimum wage, and, you know, some companies I'm sure didn't like that. But I think what motivated the coup was just this overall strategy that the United States still has in Latin America, which is to get rid of any left government that they can.
Because, do you think the CIA was behind it in the first place, that they actually called the shot?
Well, Zelaya himself said, he actually said it on Democracy Now! A couple of years ago that, yeah, he thought the U.S. was actually involved in directly involved in the coup, not just in helping it establish itself and fighting the whole rest of the hemisphere to make sure that it succeeded. He thought they were actually involved in it. He was pretty sure. And, I think that's probably likely, because the other strategic interest they have is they have military base. And that's, you know, that's something they don't have much in Latin America anymore. They lost their main base in South America, outside of Colombia, which was Ecuador when Correa was elected. And so I think they were afraid that if Honduras ever had a new constitution, one of the things they put in there is no foreign military bases, which everybody else in the world would, almost, you know, everybody in this hemisphere, I think, is on the same page as that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wasn't it Correa who said, yeah, you can have a military base here in Ecuador as long as we can have a military base in Florida.
That's right. And I think that's a standard, you know, I mean, people there see it differently than here. They don't see the United States as having special rights that nobody else has.
Yeah, I think Americans have never heard anything like that before. They're like, huh? What? A base of your military on our soil? No. All right, hold it right there. There's some more follow-up here to go over. Hillary and Obama and America's role in the 2009 coup d'etat in Honduras. We'll be back in just a sec. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. Wrapping up here for the day with Mark Weisbrot. He's got this article at America.AlJazeera.com. Hard choices. It was easy. Hillary Clinton admits role in Honduran coup. And so lots to follow up on here. First of all, when you talk about Hillary's maneuver in the Organization of American States and all of that, to basically solidify the coup, to make sure there was no going back, it's interesting that the tactic that they chose was hurry up, call a new election. So it wasn't necessarily the guys who, or, you know, the face on the coup. I don't know the details, but I guess it was not the face on the coup who ended up being elected. They sort of tried to paint a little bit of legitimacy on it by holding this election. But as she puts it, they were really just trying to make the early conclusion of his presidency a moot point by moving on as quickly as possible.
That's right. And they didn't want to have a real election. I mean, he should have been able to come back to the country before the election. That's what all of South America was demanding. And that really, as I said, isolated the U.S. Government further in the hemisphere, even worse than Bush was isolated in some ways.
And then when they had the election, was it just a joke or what?
It was pretty bad. I mean, nobody accepted it as legitimate. Almost nobody in the hemisphere other than the United States and one or two other countries that were willing to go along with the U.S. And the Europeans didn't even send observers. So, you know, for the rest of the world, it wasn't really a legitimate election.
Mm-hmm. And then, I'm sorry, I think I interrupted you there when you were about to say something else.
No, I mean, that was it. I think, you know, you could tell if you were watching this thing from the beginning that the U.S. was, you know, supporting the coup from day one. You know, the first statement that came out of the White House didn't even condemn the coup. It just called on all political and social actors in Honduras to respect democracy. Now, what does that mean? Every diplomat in Washington, D.C. knew exactly what that meant. That meant that they were behind the coup, because in the 21st century, you can't say you support a coup. So by not saying anything bad about it and just pretending like it was a dispute over an election or something, they were telling the Hondurans and the world that the coup really had the support of the United States. And so from day one, anybody who was paying attention really knew it. But as I said, most of the media pretended that the U.S. was against it.
Yeah, now, I thought I remembered some kind of little detail about Obama coming out against it, at least a little, and then Hillary accused him of going wobbly, and it was her and Lanny Davis and the whole kind of Hillary regime over there that had maybe been the ringleaders more than Obama, kind of Newland and Ukraine sort of a situation. But not that I mean to apologize for Obama or anything. Is that not right?
Well, I think that Obama, especially at that time, didn't pay a lot of attention he doesn't pay much attention to Latin America in general. But he was ultimately, in charge, and I don't think anything went on behind his back. In fact, Zelaya came to Washington 6 times after the coup, and there were people close to Obama trying to get him to just at least meet with him, and he never did it. And that, to me, showed something very strong, too. I mean, what does it take, just 5 minutes, shake hands, show that you support the elected president? But he didn't want that to be seen in the world, right? And it's not that Zelaya was some kind of pariah either. I mean, he was, besides being a democratically elected president, I mean, he hadn't done anything that anybody except the far right would really say he was terrible for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're saying it's mostly just the image that he wasn't right-wing enough, America-aligned enough, and that's enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way they see it, especially then, I'd like to believe they're, softening some right now. I'm not sure, though. The way they see it is that this is like a chess game, and it's like the Cold War. And so you have all these left governments, Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, Uruguay, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, El Salvador. They just didn't want one more. They don't want any more. And in fact, they're always trying to get rid of whoever they can. And so this was kind of a crime of opportunity, on the positive side, I should say there's been a huge geostrategic geopolitical change, in that they can't get rid of any of the sizable or medium-sized countries, governments, or even some of the smaller ones. Really, the weakest, this is like the third poorest country in the hemisphere. And the other one they got rid of course, was Haiti in 2004 and Paraguay in 2012. And the U.S. was involved in those as well. But they tried to overthrow the government of Venezuela. There was an attempted coup in Ecuador a few years ago. And there was violent attempts to topple the government of Bolivia. And all of these were, the U.S. was either involved in some way or trying to support it. They can't really do that much, except in these cases where the government is weak and they have very, very close ties with the military, as they did in Honduras.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, then when they get away with one, all they do is just solidify as though this was ever really in doubt anyway. But they just help to push public opinion against the American position in all of those countries you listed. Just like in the Middle East, just like if there's some foreign-backed coup d'etat in Louisiana, Texans and Arkansans still care, even if it's just the state next door. So, and since they've all been through this at one time or, 10 times or another, this just helps solidify Uncle Sam as the evil imperialist tyrant from the north, doing everything he can to thwart their self-determination no matter what their determination is, really. Just as long as itself, it's intolerable to the USA.
I think that's kind of it. I mean, I think that they, you know, they see this in Cold War terms, and they're trying to kind of a strategy of containment and rollback. That's what the overall strategy is mostly. Now, every now and then, the Obama administration takes a slightly different approach, or even significantly different, and then they get blocked by the right. So, for example, they tried to exchange ambassadors in 2010 with Venezuela. Venezuela is one of three countries in South America that we don't have ambassadorial relationships. The others are Ecuador and Bolivia. And so when they try and do this, then the right mobilizes, and the administration is not willing to sacrifice, you know, $2 of political capital to get this done. Relations remain strained. So in that sense, there is this disproportionate influence of the far right. But in the case of the Honduran coup, I think there was no real daylight between the Obama administration and the far right. Mm. They really did see this as an opportunity to get rid of a left government. Mm.
And now, I'm sorry, in the last minute and a half or two, could you talk about the consequences? What all, if anything, has changed in the standard of living of the people there, the drug wars and this kind of thing?
Yes, well, it definitely was terrible for Honduras. You had a 50% increase in the homicide rate. It was already the highest in the world from 2008 to 2011. A lot of political repression, murder of opposition political candidates, and this is still continuing. So the drug-related violence, of course, is a big thing, too. But the security forces have killed a lot of people, a lot of human rights crimes there, and the U.S. government still continues to give aid to the military and police, even though more than 100 members of Congress have written to the administration and asked for them to cut it off. Or to enforce conditions against them. Not too much has really happened in that regard.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. I meant to get to that earlier and give you more time to discuss that, Mark. We're all out of time. But thanks for coming back on the show. I sure do appreciate it. Great article.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, everybody. That's Mark Weisbrot. And he writes about some of the domestic consequences for the people there in this article, too. Please look at America.aljazeera.com. Hard choices. Hillary Clinton admits role in Honduran coup. See y'all tomorrow.